So we finished previously by just raising just a few little questions about what we would have to deal with when we come to our description of a boundary. So if we think about what a boundary is in space-time, it's something that is at the edge of our space-time. So if it's an edge, then it has a reduced dimensionality and its dimension is reduced by one. So our boundary is a hypersurface in space-time. So if we think about that being a lower dimensional object, then that means that what we're really thinking about are lower dimensional objects in space-time. So a lower dimensional object in space-time can, if it's suitably constructed, also be a manifold in its own right. So a submanifold is a manifold in its own right, but it's something that's living inside our manifold and is a subset of our manifold. So it's also a manifold in its own right. So that means that our submanifold sigma is endowed with a set of charts that are C infinity, it's got tangent spaces, etc., etc. So the part of geometry that deals with the description of submanifolds is usually called the Gauss-Kadatze formalism, because these were the main mathematical developers of this particular description. So to set up kind of what we're thinking about here, this is our sigma. Our manifold is somehow bigger. So actually, let me first of all think of sigma. This is my M, and here is my sigma lying in M. So the right-hand side is the picture we have. We have a notion of some subsurface or submanifold in our own manifold. I'm going to say that M has dimension capital D, that sigma has dimension little d. So of course, we have our local charts. On our manifold, and so these will induce local charts on sigma. But if I look on the left-hand side, sigma is also a manifold in its own right. So there are charts, which I'm going to call sigma A with a capital A, that take me from sigma down into the underlying little d dimensional manifold. So that is my picture And then, of course, I have a map from my manifold sigma into my space-time manifold, and that induces a map down here, which we could think of as simply saying our space-time coordinates x mu that live on sigma are functions of the local coordinates sigma a. So, the idea is, if you see a capital index here, it's an index that's associated with the manifold sigma, sigma considered as a manifold. If you see lowercase or Greek, it's the full space-time manifold.
Mm-hmm. You said we had this map from sigma to sigma d, but isn't the problem with embedding as a manifold precisely that, I mean, it depends on in what we want to embed it. It's not always possible, right? It depends on M or...
Yeah, I mean, it's not... So in this case, I'm thinking of sigma as a submanifold. So I'm actually starting with this picture because we want to describe the submanifold, okay? But I'm saying that because sigma is itself a sub... because sigma is a submanifold, it is a manifold in its own right. So therefore, I also have this parallel picture of the manifold sigma and its local charts mapping onto r to the d. So I'm really just drawing this full picture as a means of trying to, it's actually as much defining stuff. I'm defining my local coordinates on my submanifold. So from the space-time perspective, I have my space-time coordinates, x mu, and the location of sigma is x mu of sigma a, where the sigma a are the intrinsic coordinates living on sigma when I think of sigma as a submanifold. So I have two sort of pictures going on in parallel. I've got the higher dimensional picture of my space-time, and then I've got the lower dimensional picture of my surface sigma. So that's kind of what the picture is meant to communicate some of these different notation or different objects. So let's start with an easy definition or an obvious one. So if sigma has dimension little d and my manifold has dimension big D, then there's a discrepancy, big D minus little d, which we're going to call n, and that is the codimension of sigma. So that's kind of obvious. Sigma has a dimension and a codimension, and the two should sum to the dimensionality of the manifold. In reality, what does it mean? Well, if I think again of my embedding picture, my surface can have normals. So it can have normals to the surface, and those normals had better be perpendicular to the surface. So I have n linearly independent vectors. So my normals have to annihilate the coordinate functions for all of my coordinate functions. So what does that really mean? It means, if I put it in indices, so x mu of sigma a is my embedding. That's what defines my surface. It's a set of rules restricting the coordinates, my capital D dimensional coordinates, to only lie on the surface sigma. Then when I take dx mu by d sigma a, that is parallel. Those are the components, if you like, of the vector d by d sigma a. So that vector is parallel to the surface, and therefore my normal, which is normal to the surface, had better annihilate that. So just to see it sort of in you know, that this way of writing things makes sense. We take our unit two sphere. Here my x mu are just x, y, z, my Cartesians. My sigma a would be theta and phi. And my n mu is d by dr, because that's normal to the sphere. And that is xi over r d by dxi. So from our knowledge of polars, we can kind of see that n acting on sigma a is zero, but let's do it explicitly. So x mu of sigma a, should have written that down first. So that defines my surface. Those are my coordinate functions as functions of theta and phi. So if I take this here, for example, if I take A is phi, then I get sine theta, cos phi, so in this case, I'm taking A is phi, so I'm taking d by d phi of xi. So I only have to worry about the x and the y. But my normal n is also actually this same vector. And so once I take d by d phi of the x component times x and d by d phi of the y component times y and add them together, I do indeed get zero. So it sort of looks rather trivial in that example, but it's just kind of illustrating, you know, how that definition works. So our normals, obviously, they only have to be normal to the surface, but we're going to take them to be normalized as well. Moreover, we're going to take them not just to be normalized, but to be mutually orthogonal. So I want my, it's really like following the idea of an orthonormal basis. I'm just saying that my normal space to the submanifold is going to be orthon. These ends are an orthonormal basis for that normal space. A lot of normals in that sentence. Okay. Now, this minus here is plus one if n is time-like, and minus one if n is space-like. So, for example, if you wanted to do a dynamical formulation of general relativity, so you want to analyze, say you've got a particular setup in gravity and you want to see how it evolves in numerical relativity, then you'd kind of want to do a formulation of GR, which was, say, at, well, this is t equals t zero and I need to move forward in time. So that's an example of where you may want to decompose general relativity into a submanifold, which is a spatial slice, that then evolves in time. So it's one of the peculiar things about Einstein gravity is we describe our manifold as a four-dimensional object, which is kind of static in a way. You know, we simultaneously see the beginning and the end of the universe, whereas when we do normal physics, and indeed our own experience of the universe, is not like that. We see things happen in time, and you know, we predict what's going to happen when we do an observation. And that's actually somewhat, a little bit, slightly uncomfortably at odds, not quite at odds, but it's something that we have to think about when we do GR. So quite often, when we're thinking about gravitational theory, we're playing with manifolds, we're, you know, doing the grand design. But once we start trying to think about what is a prediction, what's an observable, we often end up having to break things down into things that happen at a given time. Now, in cosmology, that's kind of okay because we already have a natural breakdown. We have cosmological time. We have things sort of evolving in cosmology. Even when we do it from our four-dimensional perspective, it still naturally splits into a space and a time. But more generally, if we want to think about making predictions in gravity, we kind of have to deal with this. We have to split things up into space and time. And so this is how we do it. We kind of start to use this formalism. We have, you know, a spatial surface and a normal vector. So that is the ADM formulation, and that would be N being time-like. Now, I want to talk about boundaries of space-time, which is more like a boundary at large R or something like that. So I'm interested in a space-like normal. So from now on in, I'm just going to assume my normal is space-like. If you want to go back and rederive things for a time-like normal, you just go through and carefully add or alter signs here and there. So it's not, it doesn't, really restrict what we're doing. It's not a real restriction, but it does mean I'm not going to be putting this minus to minus I, so I'm not going to be putting this arbitrary possible minus sign in the expression. So it just makes them look a little bit cleaner. Okay, so that's set up notation and what I mean, and also I've kind of chosen a bit of a gauge here by saying, telling you about the normal space. So the first fundamental form, which is more the mathematical way of putting it, or the induced metric, which is perhaps more the physics way of putting it, is what we get when we ask what metric is living on sigma as a result of it, sigma living in M. So that's essentially what we're doing is we're taking the space-time metric, and by adding those combinations of n, we're sort of we're killing off all the bits that are normal to sigma. So I just want to note that, or to stress, that H lives in the tangent bundle of M, right? Even though it's somehow a lower dimensional quantity. But because sigma is also the manifold, I call it psi. So remember when we did maps and manifolds, and I said there was a push forward and a pull back? Well, in this case, this is an example of maps between manifolds, and we're mapping between manifolds of different dimensions. And so associated with that map psi from sigma into M, we have a pullback of the cotangent space in M back onto the cotangent space in sigma. And so a general covector, omega mu, will map to omega A, which is dx mu by d sigma A omega mu. So that's the action of the pullback. So that means we can pull back the metric. And then we get what we call the intrinsic metric. So gamma AB lies in TP star of sigma, tensor TP star of sigma. So I guess an example here might be if I have a world line. So here we do this all the time. We think of observers traveling along a particular trajectory, x mu of tau. And we just sketch it and don't really think very much about what we're doing. But in fact, that's a one-dimensional submanifold. And our gamma tau tau is x dot nu, g mu nu, which is just like ds by d tau squared. So that would be one if our geodesic was affinely parameterized. Or we chose proper time as a coordinate. Okay, so our next definition. Unsurprisingly, is the second fundamental form. And again, we have a more colloquial expression for this, which is the extrinsic curvature. And this measures how our surface curves in the manifold. So here's an example of an embedding of R into R squared, just a line of chalk on the board. I've sketched normals. And if I look, say, between these two points at how my normal changes, then as I sweep along the curve, the variations of my normal are actually parallel to the curve. So I can write this extrinsic curvature. I take the covariant derivative of n and project it down parallel to the submanifold sigma, and then take the symmetric part of it. And that is that is my extrinsic curvature. If I want to express it as an intrinsic object on sigma, I simply project down using the pullback, x mu comma a, and I can then I can then redefine this, sort of swap around the differentiation here to get what's often actually a more useful way of calculating the components of the extrinsic curvature. And d here So D is the covariant derivative that lives on sigma. So it's what you inherit on sigma from the manifold. And you simply get that by taking the manifold covariant derivative and projecting down every possible free index onto into the subspace of the, in this case, the subspace of the tangent space parallel to sigma. So once again, I want to give an example, but if I look at this, the extrinsic curvature is actually what, sorry, actually, David, would it be possible to get me some water, please? I can feel my throat going. I don't know if it's all the extra chalk does. When we think about curvature, we have this notion of curvature as literally being some sort of undulation of a surface. And so our intuitive notion of curvature is kind of when something isn't straight or flat. But that means that when we first meet a cylinder, and we're told a cylinder is flat, you know, you sort of think, yeah, sure, right. And what's happening is we are mixing up the actual intrinsic curvature of a surface, the Ricci or Riemann curvature, with the curvature of the embedding of the surface in the higher dimensional space, which is the extrinsic curvature. So our mind, our artistic eye, sees extrinsic curvature, but sees it almost the same as intrinsic curvature, but they're not. So we'll look at the cylinder to kind of see how. So first we'll look at the cylinder and compute the various curvatures, and then to fully convince that it's flat, we have to just go a couple of steps further. But here's our cylinder. We build it up by taking a circle in the XY plane and then just translating it in the Z direction. So our normal N points outwards in the XY plane. Bubbles or no bubbles? Wow, plenty of choice. There we go. Okay, so there's our cylinder. And the other reason I want to talk about the cylinder is I also want, I've emphasized when I introduced the first fundamental form, that it lived in the tangent space of the manifold. So here we'll kind of see these competing perspectives on the first fundamental form. So HAB, in this case, because we're in Euclidean R cubed, it's delta AB minus NANB. And so if I write that out as a 2x2 matrix, I actually get something that doesn't really look very helpful. So it's sort of got lots of, it's actually made life worse. I've got more components, not less, even though I've reduced the dimensionality. But that's just because I was being a bit silly. I was doing things in Cartesians. If I were to use polars, I would get something much nicer. Because my normal is just, that's cylindrical polars, sorry. My normal is simply d by dr in the xy plane. And so I just cut out that top row and first column. So if I keep in polars, KAB is gamma RAB in cylindrical polars. And that just has one component. So notice this H and K are all 3x3 matrices because they're elements of TP star, tensor TP star of R cubed. So my intrinsic coordinates are fairly obvious. I keep my Z coordinate because that tells me how far up the cylinder I am. And then I simply choose theta as the angle around the cylinder. So these are my sigma A's, my intrinsic coordinates. And then my intrinsic metric is now just a 2x2 matrix. So that's extrinsic, intrinsic. So you see that they are different objects, they're elements of different spaces. So our final step before we sort of move forward with our boundary term, got one more definition. In three dimensions, we don't have a lot of choice. We've either got a surface with one normal or a line with two normals. But obviously in higher dimensions, I've got more choice. So if we have more than one normal, say if we look at that world line, a line in three dimensions, I've got two normals. So then as I move along the line in two dimensions, I have to decide how those normals move along the line. So for example, if I just had a line of the z-axis, I could take my two normals to be x and y, move it up and down, okay? Or I could be perverse and I could say my normals twisted as I went round up and down. And so that would be an equivalently valid choice of normals. It still satisfies that my normals are unit and mutually orthogonal, but it looks more complicated and it looks like I'm making my life difficult. How does that show up in terms of this formalism? Well, it shows up in what are called the normal fundamental forms. So we call these normal fundamental forms, but what they're really doing is they're giving us a connection on this normal bundle. So we have our tangent bundle to sigma, and we have a normal bundle to sigma. Our tangent space of M splits in two, the parallel or tangent of sigma and the normal, which is the normal to sigma. And so if I were to take that example of twisting my X and Y normals as I moved up the Z-axis, that, remember, our connection is only a rule to tell us how to link tangent planes together. And so what that would correspond to would be me, you know, making my life difficult by taking a connection that's rotating the tangent plane as I move up, which is not a very natural thing to do, but it's something that I could decide I wanted to do. So as an example of something, so there's obviously a part of this normal fundamental form that is geometrical or intrinsic, you know, is associated to the embedding, and some of it is gauge. And we see that when we take the curvature, which is sort of commutators. But just to see an example of this normal fundamental form, let's take where it measures something. Let's take the helix. So I'm going to take a trajectory in R cubed, which is cos theta, sine theta, theta, my x, y, and z. So my x dot a is minus sine theta cos theta 1. So the norm of x dot is root 2. My normal is cos theta, one of them at least, is cos theta sine theta 0. I can take another normal, which is going to be minus sine theta cos theta 1, minus 1, sorry. And so if I ask what is my normal fundamental form, so I move over here. Well, my normal, if I look here, remember cos theta is x on R and sine theta is y on R, or rho, let me call it rho in the plane. So if I calculate the x component of beta, well, actually, let me just write beta I first. So this is my beta if I input n1 and n2. Hopefully in the right order. So if I look at the x component, well, it's cos theta here. So then I have to take d by dx of minus sine theta, and minus sine theta is minus y on R. So this is x over R, yx on R cubed. Then I have to take plus y over r, and then that's d by dx of cos theta, which is 1 over r minus x squared on r cubed. And then the y component is x over r d by dy of minus y over r. Plus sine theta, which is y over r, times d by dy of cos theta, which is x over r. So you see that these terms here cancel. And so what I'm left with is that my beta, sorry about, I just wanted to keep this all on one board. My beta is simply y over r squared, x over r squared. Now, on the helix, r is 1, so that's just sine theta cos theta. So that's my normal fundamental form for that choice of normal. Now, I could choose different normals, but in this particular case, I would never entirely get rid of my normal fundamental form because the helix is actually twisting. So when there's something that's non, the non-gauge part of the normal fundamental form kind of tells you about twistiness. Okay, so now let's think about, having talked about the curvature of the embedded submanifold, let's now think about actual space-time curvature or manifold curvature. I've got an intrinsic metric, or the pullback of the metric on sigma, so that's got its own curvature. That's the intrinsic curvature. How does that relate to the curvature on the manifold? So we know that the curvature on sigma can't just be some projection of the curvature on the manifold, because if we think of the two-sphere is an intrinsically curved surface, but we see it as a sphere in R cubed, and R cubed is flat. So obviously, the curvature of a submanifold isn't just coming from the higher dimensional manifold, because we can make curved surfaces in a flat space. So that tells us that the curvature on sigma has to be a combination of the curvature due to the fact that maybe the background manifold is curved, as well as some sort of curvature that you're getting from the embedding, so from the process of sigma being embedded in M. So this is summarized in the Gauss equation. Which takes tells you that the curvature on sigma is, first of all, you project out the space-time curvature onto sigma, and then you add in the embedding piece. So I'm not going to go through the algebra of proving this, because we've got 10 minutes left, but it's relatively straightforward, but with a lot of indices flying around all over the place. And basically, if you think about it, you define your curvature on sigma as via the Riemann identity, it's commutator of covariant derivatives. And so when you take that commutator of covariant derivatives, you're going to have something that's sort of already parallel to the manifold. But then also, if you look at where that covariant derivative was defined, in the middle at the top, the covariant derivative is defined as kind of projecting everything down. And so when you take a commutator, you're going to get derivatives of H. And then if you look at what defines H over on the left-hand side, you see that the first fundamental form is defined as G plus NN. So covariant derivatives of H have covariant derivatives of N in them, and covariant derivatives of N are extrinsic curvatures. So if you like, you're taking your Christoffels and you're splitting them into a bit that's due to the background space-time connection, and then a bit that is coming from like this derivative of N, so the extrinsic curvature. And so the KK pieces are like the gamma-gamma pieces. So that's the Gauss equation, and it relates space-time curvature to the submanifold curvature. So now I want to go back and return to the question that kind of motivated this whole thing. So I've got to find what we were trying to solve. Where's our boundary term that we were bothered about? There it is. Okay, that was the term that we got when we integrated up the variation of our Einstein-Hilbert tensor. So now let's think about what maybe we could do. So now I want to be very specific. And I'm considering my sigma as being a boundary on my manifold. So I have codimension one. And I'm going to make my life easy, I'm going to say that my normal NA extends geodesically into the bulk. So the bulk is, of course, the manifold M. So I do this, my normal, I have complete freedom how I extend it off the submanifold, and I'm doing this to make my life easy. So remember that N squared is minus one, and H mu nu is G mu nu plus N mu N nu, and grad N of N is zero. Okay, so now I'm going to think about what happens if I'm thinking of a variation. So I have to think about how the variation of G spreads itself into G mu nu and N mu. So whatever I do when I vary my manifold metric, I have to remain, N has to still be a normal. That's my first rule. I can fiddle with G, but my N is still a normal. So N squared is still minus one. So I simply vary this. I get two variations of N, which is that. And then I get a variation of G, which I turn into a variation of G inverse. Next, I want N, again, to be a normal, which means that if once I finish my variation, my new N has to be normal to my new G. So, once again, I simply write out explicitly what that means. So all I'm doing here is saying that once I've finished, once I'm looking, finished with my variation, N still has to be a unit normal to the surface, to the boundary. But now I use my expression for H. So H is G plus NN. Oops, what am I doing? There we go. So I take each side of this expression. On the left-hand side, I replace for H. And on the right-hand side, I've taken delta of H. Then I look at what I've got here. Here I've got an N dotted with delta N. And on the right-hand side, I've got N dotted with delta N. So this term cancels with that term. And then if I look at this second delta N piece, I've got an N squared, which is minus one. So the second piece is delta N sigma G sigma nu with a minus sign. And so it's actually the same as the right-hand side, so I can pull them over. So what I've actually got are two copies of this, and I then raise my index to see that delta N mu is actually equal to 1/2 of N nu delta G mu nu. So that tells me now that the variation of my normal is actually just taking the one of the normal, a sort of normal piece of delta G. So that kind of makes sense, because if I think about doing a very, you know, sort of possible variations of the metric, I've chosen my gauge. I'm specifying that my normal is a unit normal. So if N changes, it can, or the specific components of N change, they only change because G is changing. So now I want to construct, what I'm really trying to do is I want to construct a term to add to the action, a boundary term whose variation is going to cancel the boundary term that I get from the Euler-Lagrange variation. So I'm looking for a boundary term. So I've already got a scalar, and it has a meaning. It has a geometrical meaning, the extrinsic curvature. So let me sort of explore what happens with delta K. So delta K is the change in the divergence of the normal. So that is going to be the divergence of the change in the normal plus the change in grad due to changing the metric. Okay, so the first term I substitute in for delta N mu, using what I just derived, so I get this. And the reason is I want to have something that's in terms of delta G inverse. And then the second term, delta of gamma mu mu, you know, delta of the trace of this Christoffel is just simply the grad lambda of G delta G. And of course the minus sign comes because I'm taking delta G inverse. So, writing this out here in full, what I get is 1/2 of N nu d mu delta G mu nu, which is great because I want that. This piece gives me grad N of delta G. Good, I want that as well. And then I also get plus 1/2. Then I've got the derivative of N, which is going to give me a K delta G mu nu. Okay, so I've basically got the term that I wanted, because if I look now at what I wrote at the very top there, that is the normal derivative of delta G inverse and n dotted with, sorry, I'll put that delta g inverse there, and n dotted with delta g. So if I take so here, this is my boundary term. So just to sort of finish off, if I take root hk as my boundary term, so I'm going to take the integral of root hk v3x, then root g actually equals root h in my gauge, because remember, the modulus of n squared is 1, then I get I think I've missed a step here in what I've written down. Okay, so if I take a boundary, my boundary term is the integral of root hk, and I vary it, I get the piece that I want that's going to cancel the integration by parts in the Euler-Lagrange process, and then I get an extra piece. The reason I haven't just said I want to set that to zero is just that it's something I may want to come back to. But what this then means is if I choose this boundary term properly normalized, minus 1 over 8 pi g integral k root h, so if I add this boundary term, which is the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, that's what GH stands for, then I get a properly defined variational principle. If I choose, all I'm interested in is the bulk equation, put it over here so I don't have to. If I'm only interested in the bulk, then delta M is non-dynamical. So delta GAB equals zero on delta M, and my boundary piece variations cancel. And all I get is the Einstein term that I want. But actually, I've gone a bit further here. I could have a dynamical boundary. In which case, I would have this second term over here. And I would then get an additional boundary equation of motion which would be something of the form of KAB minus a half KHAB, would have to then equal 8 pi G SAB. So this would now be a boundary or something of this. May mean a 4 there. I'm not sure to come back on that. So this now is not only given us a nice way of returning to the Einstein-Hilbert action and making the Euler-Lagrange process rigorous, it's actually also had this little additional bonus of telling us that if we want to have a dynamical boundary, we have an equation of motion for the boundary. And this was actually first investigated by Werner Israel in the 60s, where he was looking at shells of dust in astrophysics. He didn't do this submanifold formalism. He simply looked at thin shells and integrated the Einstein equations across the shell, but that's really kind of the same thing from a physical perspective. And so these are called the Israel, in the end, they give you, these not called because I've got to do it from each side, the Israel junction conditions. So I've overrun, so I'll stop.